So what did you guys think of Arun's lecture? Was it good?
Yeah.
Good. Yeah, he's real good. I'll have to listen to it. I'm looking forward to it. So today I want to follow up on his general mobile GPU stuff and talk about some of the graphics stuff on mobile. And it's really like, how is the graphics pipeline implemented? And just a small part of it. And this is really going to be a primer on something called tile-based architectures, which are quite different than what you'll see on a lot of the desktops, which are immediate mode rendering. And that has implications for us as graphics developers in terms of how do you write the best code. Like some optimizations that you do on a desktop would actually hurt performance on a mobile and vice versa. So I want to just do a primer on that. For the reading, I gave you guys two chapters from OpenGL Insights. And these chapters are awesome. These are probably my favorite two. If I were allowed to pick two favorites, these would be, I think, the best two chapters in the book. One of which was written by John McCaffrey, who was the TA here last spring and took this class maybe 2.5 years ago. So we'll see which of you writes a chapter in OpenGL Insights too. And then the other, Bruce Mary, did a fantastic job with his chapter. And the reading goes deeper than what we're going today. Probably, I'm trying to actually be done in 30 minutes, and if I were to cover both those chapters, it probably would take the full 80 minutes. So before we go into the details, though, let's just talk about all the logistics coming up with the course. So homework 5 is due today, you know, submitted anytime today to the repo for your team. Then Wednesday we'll do a small quiz, and like I say, like if you understand all the code, your quiz is easy. And if you only coded half of it, then the quiz, you'll get like a 50, would be my guess. And then after you guys do the quiz, I want to hear your experience for if you think the pair programming was a good idea and doing the follow-up quiz, because I definitely want to foster collaboration and still want to make sure that everyone learns the information as opposed to like half of the class just sliding by on their partners. And then we'll have, that will be the last class, Wednesday. So we're not going to have class this coming Monday, as I said in the email. I'll give you guys off because the following Wednesday, so 1 week from this Wednesday, we'll do your final project presentation. So that way you get, that's the first day for the first reading day. You get like 3 reading days between classes and finals. That's the first one. So this way you'll get like 2 extra days to do your project if you need it. And we'll have a 3-hour time slot, 9 a.m. to noon, in 307 Town, which is like almost right above us. I didn't know that. I walked all the way around the building to find 307 Town. But this way, we're not going to be rushed, because if we did it in a class period, you'd get 3 or 4 minutes each. So, like I said in the email, go for like a 7-minute presentation, and that will give us 3 minutes for setup and questions and various overhead. For your presentation, demos, live demos are good. Bring your laptop or hope it runs on my laptop. Live demos, videos are fine too. Performance analysis, you know, definitely do that. That's like, you gotta show us performance numbers. And then there will probably be some people there that might not be familiar with their work, so just a very quick primer on what you did is fine. It's just 30 seconds. And then before you come to your presentation on Wednesday, post your code, your 3-page paper, and your 4-minute video on your blog. And your code can just be a link to your GitHub repo.
What should be included in the 4-minute video?
In the 4-minute video, that's completely up to you. It could be entirely demo with some voiceover or text over, or it could be a combination of some architectural diagrams and things like that. But you know, it should be as if you were submitting, say you were submitting like a poster to SIGGRAPH, and they'll ask for a video, an optional video, although I wouldn't say that it's optional, that kind of highlights your work. So you should just be trying to just demonstrate and show the most interesting things that you did. And then we'll do one-on-one demos later that day. I sent out the Excel spreadsheet for the time slots. So, and then those will just be, you know, expect 10 minutes, maybe less or more, depending on how familiar I am with your work already. And then that's it. The projects are done at that point, and then we'll move on to the stuff for the final. But that's small change compared to the projects themselves. Any questions about any homework 5 or the projects? And I've been following up on your blogs, and I'll take another look at them today or tomorrow, too. So far, like, you guys have done great, very good work as a whole from the class. All right, so let's look a little bit then at the tile-based architectures that we see in mobile. And really, I'll just talk a little bit about the motivation, which as you guys can guess is power, or a combination of power and performance. We'll look a little bit under the hood at the implementation of one of these tile-based architectures, and this is under the OpenGL abstraction. And then we'll talk about a few implications in terms of optimizing our code, which I think are pretty interesting. And these tile-based architectures, I think we're going to see them on desktops. Like, these are, they're good for power, they're good for performance, and those things also matter on desktops, and we'll see, as time moves forward, I think we'll see them on desktops. And then also, as I start to get ahead of myself, Tegra 3, as far as I know, did Varun talk about Tegra 3 at all, or Tegra 2 maybe? So Tegra 3 is the NVIDIA's processor system on a chip. It's got like a four vertex shaders, eight fragment shaders, still separate shader processors. I think, you know, when I saw Tegra 2 to Tegra 3, their GPU didn't get a whole lot better. It was kind of like GeForce 6 to GeForce 7. And then the GeForce 8 came out, and that's when they went to a unified shader architecture, a much different system. So I have a feeling that the next Tegra that comes out is going to be tile-based. That's my guess. But anyway, let's talk about what this thing is and why it exists. So memory bandwidth. I know when we were doing CUDA, we beat memory bandwidth to death, right? And we're all talking about bandwidth and trying to minimize the amount of transfer that we're doing to global memory. And I probably didn't talk about this as much as I should have in terms of the graphics side, but let's just loosely come up with some numbers, right? Say we're doing 32-bit color, okay? So that's RGBA channels at 8 bits each. And you might not even need the alpha channel, but let's just say maybe we're compositing it with something else. So let's just say you need 32 bits. So we need 4 bytes per pixel to display an image. You guys comfortable with that? It's a reasonable thing to say. But when you look at all the data that went into shading that pixel, I mean, how many bytes did we have to transfer? I mean, maybe 12 bytes, because maybe we wrote to the color, maybe that's 4 bytes. And then there's the depth and stencil. And depth is usually 24 bits, stencil is usually 8 bits, and they're usually stored together, so that's 4 bytes. So read and write of that would be 4 plus 4 plus color plus 4, so that's 12 bytes. And again, I'm not even looking at vertex data or any of that other stuff. I'm just at the tail end of the pipeline here when we're doing rasterization, shading, blending, all that. So maybe 12 bytes, that's still very, very low, because your fragment shader is reading from textures, right? I mean, just think about homework 5 right now with the image processing. So depending on the size of your kernel, you know, you're reading quite a bit of data from various textures. Also, overdraw. Remember we talked about the difference between a fragment and a pixel, and you might have many fragments that eventually fight to become a pixel. So every fragment has a lot of memory bandwidth, but only one of those becomes a pixel at the end of the frame. And then blending operations that we talked about for translucency, where you're reading from the color buffer and then doing an equation to blend it with your output color to do translucency. And then also multi-sampling, which Adam talked about, to do anti-aliasing, which can dramatically increase the amount of memory bandwidth. So, you know, you're looking at, if I just pull a number out of thin air, actually I'll pull a number out of your chapter, which is, you know, 100 bytes or more per pixel is not uncommon or is not unreasonable. In fact, I would argue even significantly higher would be common. Okay, so we know there's a lot of memory bandwidth, and then let's look at something called an IMR, immediate mode rendering. Do not confuse this with the OpenGL immediate mode way to transfer vertex data from the CPU to the GPU, which I didn't touch on at all in this class because it's ancient and we should never do it. It's ancient, it's deprecated, and it's a horrible idea. But OpenGL itself, its abstraction, kind of represents draw a triangle or draw primitives given this state. Right? That's all we do. We say, okay, I'm going to use this vertex, I'm going to use these shaders, I'm going to set these uniforms, I have these textures, now draw. And then you repeat it. Set the state, draw, set the state, draw, set the state, draw. And that's how OpenGL presents its abstraction. It also says, the spec says, that triangles are drawn in the order they're received. Okay, so if you have a bunch of triangles in a vertex buffer, the order that they're in there is the order that they're going to get rasterized, or they're going to appear to get rasterized. So this is just an abstraction. OpenGL specifies a virtual pipeline So under the hood, we're allowed to reorder data, we're allowed to reorder draw calls, we're allowed to do things in parallel, we're allowed to do whatever we want to do to get the best performance. Now let me show you, in terms of media mode rendering, the common setup here where geometry processor, think of that, that's just really vertex shading, and then primitive assembly. And then here, we're on chip, you go right into your fragment processing, rasterization, shading, etc. And then only here, at the end of the pipeline, are we going out to main memory to access the depth and stencil buffer, the color buffer, et cetera, et cetera. So you're on chip until the end, where you're accessing the frame buffer, and the frame buffer is out in global memory. Okay, so here is where you're getting when I pull, say, 12 bytes or 100 bytes. It's all right here, crossing from one chip to global memory. And one of these problems with the immediate mode rendering is you can have a lot of overdraw. So here, say I'm drawing three triangles, blue, red, green. Look at the amount of overdraw here, where we didn't need to draw any of this because the red covered it up. We didn't need to draw any of this because the green covered it up, right? So you had all that extra memory bandwidth. So there's a lot of really common techniques that we do on the desktops that are well known, that have been around, I'd say, for at least 10 years. Yeah, probably 10 years. The first is we'll sort. So for rendering translucent objects, we talked about sorting back to front. And we needed to sort back to front so the blending would composite correctly. In order to minimize overdraw, we can sort front to back. And since we talked about early Z, where the depth test can happen before fragment shading, now you're not going to have any of the bandwidth for writing to the depth of the color buffers here. So, and you're not going to run the fragment shader either. Right, so this is a very common technique, sorting front to back. I think we might have mentioned it at least briefly in passing this semester. It's not as easy as you'd think because you have to, if your camera's moving or your objects are moving, which is really common in interactive graphics, this is view dependent. You have to do this every frame over and over again. You have to come up with efficient ways to sort. And a lot of times, you can just do a coarse sort, like a bucket sort, or you can just break it up into, you know, 10 different buckets or 12 different buckets from the viewer's perspective and drop things in the bucket. Because your sorting doesn't affect correctness, it just affects performance. So you have to balance the amount of work you spend on the CPU to optimize for the GPU in this case. Now there's another technique that we use, or we do a depth prepass, where what we do is we do a depth-only pass. So we're going to actually render the scene twice. Again, we're going to write more code and conceptually do more work in order to get a performance gain. So you render the scene one time, and you use trivial fragment shaders. You know, they're almost as trivial as, like, you know, they do basically nothing. They do, like, GL frag color equals vec4 1. Although you turn off writing to the color buffer, you're only going to write to the depth buffer. And on a lot of video cards, you'll get double speed Z only. That came out like, geez, GeForce 4, maybe a long time ago it came out. It came out so long ago that people don't even mention it anymore, assuming the cards still do it. But that's a really quick pass because you're not doing any of the heavy shading. You're not reading from text. Well, you might read from textures if you need to deal with like alpha channels, but a lot of times your shading will be very simple. So you lay down Z, that's what they'll say, you lay down Z, do the Z prepass or depth prepass. So everyone knows when I say Z or depth, they're really talking about the same thing. Now on your second pass, now you render your with all your shaders, no need to write to the depth buffer, but you read from it. And now with early Z, assuming opaque objects here, you're only going to shade objects that are visible. So your depth complexity for shading drops down to essentially one fragment per pixel at the cost of this extra depth-only pass. Now, so the depth-only pass, what do we pay? We have to transform all the vertex data twice, okay? But it's not as bad as you think because a lot of applications are CPU-bound. And when you go to draw this, you got to do two passes. Your passes are not going to be equally expensive. Like, your first pass may do a lot of work. So if you look at the whole rendering architecture where you're going to do calling, you're going to do state sorting, you're going to update your vertex buffers animation and all, when you add the Z pass, you're not going to double the amount of work you have to do. It's really going to be pretty simple. because all it is just going through your stuff and saying set state draw, set state draw, set state draw. You know, you don't have to add more calling or more more state sorting or just more vertex data updates. So these techniques are super common. Most game engines you'll see will do these. So in fact, I think next semester I might do an assignment where people implement, they do performance analysis on sorting front to back, depth only, doing a depth only pass, et cetera, so they can see the trade-offs. Okay, any questions about this front to back sorting, depth pre-pass? And it's the early Z test that really enables a lot of this in terms of reducing the amount of fragment shading. And this also reduces the bandwidth. Okay. Okay, so now we start, that's immediate mode rendering with early Z. Now we start talking about tile-based rendering. Okay, so bandwidth uses a significant amount of power. That's what these architecture guys tell me. So in mobile graphics, right, we're looking to minimize the amount of bandwidth because we can minimize the amount of power use and extend battery life. And at the same time, less bandwidth is also going to lead to better performance, or can lead to better performance because you have more bandwidth to play with overall. So the goal of a tile-based architecture is to minimize the amount of times we go to global memory to access the frame buffer. So let's go back to this picture. So it's really trying to minimize how often we're crossing from one chip to DRAM they show here, from crossing from the yellow to the blue. Do you guys have any ideas on how you might re-architect this pipeline you see here to minimize access? Add cache is maybe a valid answer, but I won't take that because I'm looking for something bigger. All right, let's take a look. Okay, so tile-based rendering, as you can imagine from the name, is we'll break the frame buffer up into tiles. It's my understanding that most vendors don't actually publish how big their tiles are, because I know when I reviewed this chapter, I'm like, how big are the tiles? and the author's like, he couldn't tell me, or he said that the vendors kind of hold that information back. But they're at least 16 by 16 pixels, and I imagine that they might even be twice that size, or I'm not sure how much bigger. Yeah, actually 16 by 16, maybe 48 by 48 at the biggest would be my guess, again, only guess. So we break up the frame buffer and the tiles, okay? This is hopefully that's pretty straightforward looking at that picture here. Oh, and this picture comes from the PowerVR guy. PowerVR is used like an iPad 2 and iPhone 4S or 4G. The PowerVR architecture guide is really good. In addition to these chapters I printed you, if you guys are like super into tile-based rendering, check out the PowerVR architecture guide. I just discovered it yesterday. Okay, so we break up the screen into tiles, and now what we're going to do is we're going to render one tile at a time. Okay, we're going to figure out what primitives overlap a given tile, and then we're going to rasterize, and we're going to shade, and we're going to depth test just those primitives. Okay, so the top image up here shows you that we're going to draw two primitives, and for this particular tile outlined in red, both primitives overlap it, and then we're just going to rasterize that one part of the tile, or that one part of the frame buffer. And then here's another example, where here we have three triangles, and then you look at what tile, upper left, upper right, lower left, and it's showing you what part is getting rasterized in each tile. Okay, so we break through the tiles, we render the primitives that overlap each tile for each tile. Why do we do this? Right, so we can store tiles on chip because we break them up so they're small enough so that they fit on chip. The entire frame buffer doesn't fit on chip, but one particular tile will. Almost think like CUDA, global memory, or shared memory. Now, part of the beauty here is to see the final result, you only need the color buffer, you only need color information in global memory. So depth and stencil, for example, that can all be on chip. Now, if you need the depth buffer later, say you're doing post-processing effects that rely on the depth buffer, say like a depth of field or ambient occlusion or something like that, then of course you'll eventually need to write out the depth buffer. But for a common case, you don't necessarily need to. Okay, so we just have color and global memory, and then we have a local copy for a tile for color, depth, and stencil on chip, so it's really fast to access it. And then as you're rendering the primitives for that particular tile, everything happens on chip. And then once you're done rendering that tile, then you sync out the color back to main memory, right? So this is, you know, think matrix multiplied. You guys remember that far back in CUDA, right? So, I mean, it's the same thing. It's even the same term, right? Tie on. But here's the million-dollar question for this architecture. How do we deal with vertex shading? How do we deal with the front end of the pipeline? Let me give you a naive way to do this. For every tile, I retransform and reshade every vertex. And then I figure out what primitives overlap my particular tile. Does that sound good? What sounds bad about that? Yeah, Knopf's right. I mean, what if I broke up the screen into, you know, I don't know how many tiles it will be, but say several hundred tiles, and now we're going to transform those several hundred times and do an overlap test several hundred times? So what do you guys think we should do?
Store it somewhere.
Good answer. So potentially surprisingly, this is what we're going to do. We're going to transform the vertex data just once. Okay? And we're going to take all the output from that. So, for example, think of your vertex shader. Think of GL position and any varyings coming out of that. We're going to store those. We're going to store the fragment shader and uniforms that are associated with that data. And we'll store any fixed function state, like the depth test, for example. Depth test is probably the most prominent one, scissor test, et cetera. We'll store this in a spatial data structure called the frame data. And when I say spatial data structure, this is stuff Peter went over as the first student presentation a while back, where this data is going to be efficiently access it given a spatial query, so that given a tile, we can very quickly look into the frame data and say what primitives are in this tile. And we'll have all the information that we need to rasterize and shade a primitive because we stored it, we saved it off from the vertex shader. Cool so far? Where do you think I'm going to store the frame data? Oh, you got two answers, global memory or on chip?
Probably going to be on chip.
On chip. I hope it's on the chip. But do you think it's going to fit on the chip?
No, I'm not sure.
No. So Knopf is right. So I believe there are some caches on the chip. But in general, the frame data has to go out to global memory because there's too much of it. So what you're doing here is we're trading global memory access for the frame buffer for global memory access for the frame data. Okay, and this frame data, this is the terminology used in the book. Different vendors will call those different things. Like I think ARM will call it polygon lists, or maybe that's PowerVR. But there's different terms for it, just so you know. So we're just using the term frame data. But it turns out that this is a really good trade-off to make. So we almost always save significantly more memory access in the frame buffer than the extra bandwidth we spend accessing the frame data. So here's the new picture. We do the geometry processor, which again I'd say is vertex shading, primitive assembly. Frame data goes out to global memory. Now your fragment shading, rasterization, shading, et cetera, reach from that frame data. But then it accesses the tile buffer for color, depth, and stencil all locally. And eventually only the color comes out when you're done shading, rendering that tile. So when we look at a scene and we know how many vertices relative to how many fragments are there, this is a really good trade-off to make because there's usually a lot more fragments or a lot more pixels than there are vertices. Right, you guys see that trade-off there? So you're not reading from the frame data as much as you would think. However, this has implications in that now the more vertices you have, more expensive vertex shading, or say outputting more vertex data from a vertex shader, is now more of a problem on a tile-based architecture like mobile than it is on a desktop with the immediate mode architecture because you have more data overall. And Unity is a really popular engine, right? They recommend up to 40,000 triangles per scene on their mobile stuff. Okay, so obviously you guys see the difference here, which is when you're going to global memory, right? Tile-based, go for the frame buffer, keep all the individual fragments local on chip to the very end, you put out color. Okay, so just a couple notes about programming this thing. GLClear clears the frame buffer. Okay, you can make a clear color, depth, stencil, or any combination of them. And this used to be, I assume like before I was in graphics, that this was literally like a mem set, like it literally like cleared the buffer. And people came up with techniques to not do clears because we were trying to get performance at any cost. So they would do things like, well, we always render the skybox first. The skybox is literally a big box that fits around your scene that has like a sky texture. Then we don't need to actually clear the buffers because we implicitly clear it when we draw that skybox. Or likewise, people would do things where they split the depth range, you know, between 0 and 0.5 and 0.5 and 1, and then switch the order of the depth tested and go and ping pong per frame so they didn't have to clear depth buffer. This is a horrible idea. Today it's a horrible idea. It wasn't a horrible idea, you know, 10 or 12 years ago. You want to clear it because the tile-based architecture will use the clear to know that you're done with the frame, and then it can discard the frame data, right? Because a frame, like OpenGL doesn't necessarily define what a frame is. It's really up to your application, like when you start rendering and when you swap buffers. And apparently, like, the swap buffer doesn't always know that it's the end of the frame. I think depending on what library you're using. So it's good to make sure that when you're on tile-based architecture to do the clears. The other thing I want to mention is even if you're not on tile-based architecture, even on today's desktops, they have a lot of Z compression and hierarchical Z. And you want to do a clear because over time, your compression of the buffers would degrade, and a clear kind of restores that. And a clear on a desktop is super fast. Like, I'm pretty sure that you have like a tree of hierarchical Z data, and it kind of like sets the top of it, and it's, you know, just like sets the root node. It's like, oh, you're cleared now, and it's very quick. Okay, so also on the desktop, there's an extension, EXT discard frame buffer, where you can instead of relying on the clear, you can explicitly say, I'm done with these frame buffers. And then it under the hood, it can know that it can get rid of the frame data. Okay, so a slight variation on tile-based rendering is tile-based deferred rendering, not to be confused with the general topic of deferred rendering, where you're rendering out all your materials to different G buffers and then doing post-processing effects to do the shading in order to get a lot of different lights in the same scene. So tile-based deferred rendering, this is what's done on PowerVR. Like I said, that's iPad 2, recent iPhone. So here what it does is only fragments that actually contribute to the scene are shaded. So see this image on the left-hand side here? Now, on the right-hand side, we see that same image, but we're looking at it from the left point of view. And it's trying to show that it didn't shade this part of the green ball or this part of the red box because it was occluded. So what a tile-based deferred renderer does is when it's working on a particular tile, first it figures out what fragments contribute to the pixel, and then it only shades those. So it kind of does, you know, I don't know if it exactly sorts it, although if it did sort it, it could do other cool things, like translucency. So it figures out what's visible and only shades those. So that's nice for reducing the amount of redundant fragment shading that can happen. And then my million-dollar question for you guys is, in that type of architecture, would you still want to do front-to-back sorting or the depth prepass? So if we did say, this was looking at front-to-back sorting. If we do front-to-back sorting in the immediate mode renderer with early Z, we're doing this to take advantage of early Z, so we minimize the amount of color and depth buffer writes, and we minimize the amount of shading, fragment shading that happens. But in a tile-based deferred renderer, you don't have overdraw because the tile processing figures out only the fragments that contribute to the scene. So if we were to sort front to back, it really doesn't matter. Now, this isn't true of all tile-based renders, but for tile-based deferred renders, where it does that visible surfaces before it does the shading, the front-to-back sorting doesn't matter. In fact, it can adversely affect performance because you're going to spend a lot more CPU time sorting when you really don't need to. Okay, so I think that's all I got. Good on time. What questions do you guys have about tile-based architectures compared? Yep.
What about translucency
and deferred shading? In general, or in this architecture, in general, deferred shading.
General.
Yeah, so it's hard. Most commonly, in deferred shading, they'll use that for all their opaque objects, and then they'll put in a separate translucency pass. That's a forward render, that's traditional rendering. Occasionally, you'll see people do, at least you'll see people talk about doing screen door translucency, where every other pixel you can see through it, and it essentially looks like 50% translucent. Or you'll see games that just won't do translucency. And I'm trying to think of an example. Like, 2 years ago, a SIGGRAPH, Little Big Planet, are you guys familiar with that game on PlayStation 3? They do deferred rendering, and that guy gave an awesome talk at SIGGRAPH. Mm-hmm. And I forget, I think he said that he just wasn't going to do translucency because they didn't want to write the forward renderer, but then I think he changed his mind later and eventually wound up adding that. So yeah, so it's a hard problem. And I think there might be some other hacks to do it, but they might be specific to different architectures, so I don't want to mislead you. What other questions you guys have? Okay, Zubin's not here, is he? All right, so I guess we have just one student presentation today, so hopefully you're not nervous because you're up first now. You're supposed to be up second, but